we talk about entrepreneurship, naturally, most of us think about startups and the founder story. We think about growth and scaling and funding rounds and a certain type of personality, perhaps, and what it takes to take an idea and turn it into that cool company we've all heard about. But of course, to be entrepreneurial, to be a visionary business leader, that happens in all sorts of businesses, large and small, across any sector you can name. To be an entrepreneur, perhaps, is to be the driving force behind a mission. To be consistently problem-solving to help deliver on a brand or company's core mission. And sometimes, very often in fact, the right leader for a business isn't part of the founding story. But they come along later when experience and a fresh perspective is needed to make a vision reality. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. On this week's show, we meet Alejandro Bethlen, the CEO of leading direct-to-consumer floral brand, The Books. The California-based company was launched in 2012 by John Tabas, an expert in brand and storytelling, and Juan Pablo Montefor, a farmer in Ecuador. By working closely with farms and a network of select florists, The Books helps to cut out the middleman, meaning you can enjoy your flowers for longer, and they can pay their suppliers more to invest in sustainable practices. After a funding round earlier this year, The Books set out to find the CEO who could help them expand their reach abroad, and to continue shaking up the $100 billion global floral industry. Alejandro brings more than 20 years of experience in scaling global businesses for Fortune 100 companies, including Amazon and Procter & Gamble, and is an expert in product, strategy, logistics, and leading a team. He made the move from Amazon in Germany to California during the height of the lockdown, an interesting personal journey, but also an inspiring shift into a different way of working. But Alejandro has no illusions about changing the direction of the business. Instead, he explains why the best strategy is to remember what you do best as a brand. He has some great advice for business leaders coming up as well, but first, the story of how he came to join The Books.
So The Books is a company that was started by J.P. Montefor and John Tabas. And the whole concept came about improving the customer experiences as in regards to flowers, right? So if you think of the traditional flower model that you'll hear is you'll call a phone number, you'll go to a website, place an order, and what they do is they connect you to the nearest florist to the zip code you're trying to ship. Because of that, the whole intermediation of the supply chain has an impact on the type of flowers some of these flower shops are selling. So what we decided to do, or what the founders decided to do, is what would it look like if we were sending flowers directly from the farm to the customer? And so that's the whole premise that the company was founded on. And that's what we're trying to expand into different avenues, into subscriptions, into businesses. How can we get farm fresh flowers that last longer to your home? And so what that allows us to do is give them more and better quality flowers for a better price. But just as important, or more importantly, is from a consumer perspective, when you receive the flowers, instead of them lasting 4 to 8 days, they can last up to 2 weeks. And so you kind of see the whole transformation of the flower in that time. And so to me, it has a huge impact on the longevity, and so the enjoyment of the flowers by the customer.
That subscription model is something new, I think, in sort of the world of flowers. People might stop off at their local shop or, you know, order on a special occasion, let's say, or want to send flowers to someone. But that's a huge area of potential growth for you. Can you talk to us a little bit about that subscription model and sort of how that is part of your thinking now?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously customers more and more are getting used to subscription models and the benefits that they bring. You know, to me, there's a bit of an awareness with flowers. There's nobody that would tell you that I don't want flowers around me all the time. However, based on your schedule at work, at home, with your kids, you may or may not have time to buy flowers. So if you think of Europe and the cities with the more dense cities, you can't walk more than 3-4 blocks without seeing a flower shop. That reminds you about flowers. You often stop and buy the flowers, and you see that flowers are more embedded in the day-to-day in Europe than they are in the U.S. So to me, the whole concept of being able to help you get the flowers directly to your door in better quality than you could get them at the supermarket or at the flower shop, and without you having to go out of your way to buy them, was a concept that to me was super interesting, especially with the cost dynamics that you can hit by having a recurring revenue stream like that, where you don't have to spend money on the customer acquisition cost for each single purchase. And so to me, when I was interviewing, that was probably one of the most exciting opportunities for me. And there's different ways we want to hit this subscription. There's the for me, you know, I'd love fresh flowers in my house, you know, every 2 weeks, every month, every couple of months. One of the amazing things onboarding onto this brand is every time you watch somebody open the box and see the flowers, you literally see their facial expressions change. And so how do we bring that to your house every month? The second component that we haven't really fleshed out well yet, but I think is going to be something that'll do very well, is going to be based on the schedule functionality. So imagine that you, Daniel, says, you know what, there's 10 birthdays I just can't forget every year. And it's difficult to always remember, find the time to buy the present and so forth. You can put those 10 dates into our system, the person's name, the person's address, and automatically they're sent flowers on their birthday or on your wedding anniversary or on whatever you would like it to be. So you don't have to worry about remembering all the days and going and finding and sending something. And the third component is going to be around businesses. You know, I think that if you look at COVID and as people come back to the office, I think kind of having an inviting atmosphere will be important. Density won't be as much of an issue. And so we want to bring this whole concept of flowers in the workplace a little bit more to the forefront. Historically, one of the difficulties to flowers in the workplace is just being able to get them there on a regular basis in regular quantities. And that's something operationally we can take over. So you often see companies that have plants, potted plants throughout the office, but rarely flowers. And what we want to do is say, look, you know, as we're coming back, as the mood is where it is and we'd like to improve it and make it lighter, how do we ensure that you have flowers in the workplace once a month, once every 2 weeks? So that's where we think the subscriptions, the buckets of the subscriptions will lie.
You know, I enjoy the sort of optimism you have for people looking for flowers and where they might have those. I mean, the office would be a wonderful place. Obviously, taking away some of the pain points to delivery and for customer access to the product is absolutely massive. But I wonder if you look at sort of telling that whole journey of the actual product. Obviously, these days, people will want a little bit more information about that product, obviously, where it comes from and how it is coming to them. You know, here in Europe, we might well know about all the massive fields and greenhouses in the Netherlands and how that transport network works. But you're sort of more localized to North America, Central America, South America. So talk to us a little bit about that part of the journey and how you're sort of telling the story of your partners, because you must have some wonderful partners that are growing these flowers for you.
Without a doubt. And I think there's a lot of parallels when you look at what happened in the coffee industry in the U.S. It was a nameless, brandless commodity. And over time, it's become a very premium coffee with different brands that tell the origin story of the coffee. Where it comes from, who they're buying it from, how they're giving back to that community, this community, et cetera. And that's kind of the vision I have for the books, right? Is I think that we're doing a pretty good job at explaining where we're getting the flowers, including farmer stories on a lot of the bouquets that you would choose that tell you where we're getting that specific bouquet from. But I'd love to continue that so that in any bouquet you buy, you're able to see which farm it's coming from, what that farm story is, what the farm specializes, is any key information about or interesting information about the farm. But at the same time, ensuring that we have a bit of a flywheel in the community give back, which is helping make sure that they're fair trade certified, organic certified, helping make sure that we can also give back to those communities. There's a large percentage of the flower pickers, of the people that work on the farms, are female. A large percentage of our customers are female. So how do we give back to the customers at the farms? How do we find ways to give back to the communities that we serve here in the U.S.? And so those are things that we're trying to develop. I think that we're now at the stage that we need to start thinking, articulating, and executing against those type of things.
And interestingly, that probably, the way you think about it, probably helps those growers to boost their own profile, just like in coffee, telling the stories of those origins. You know, I would love to just hear a little bit about your own journey over to Los Angeles. You have spent a good portion of your career in the United States, we should say, but in the past few months, you've made the move from the Munich area to Los Angeles in a very interesting time and difficult time, obviously, given restrictions. But talk to me just a little bit about actually coming in to take over the CEO role. Oftentimes we speak to people about sort of the ground up story of starting and then growing a business, but I find it so fascinating to join at a certain part of the journey. So talk to me a little bit about the actual move for you and why you thought it was a good time to join the family.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, it's a great question. And I think it's a nuanced one. I think that making this type of jump from the companies that I've worked with, which for the last 15, 20 years have been larger companies, into a growth company in and of itself is a big decision. And then compound that, changing countries, compound that with COVID, a lot of the restrictions, compound that with a lot of the rioting and protesting we saw in the US. It's definitely a time frame of my life it'll be impossible to forget. So the decision for me was, you know, I love Amazon. Amazon, I feel like my experience at Amazon and my experience at Procter gave me two slightly different leadership philosophies of how we manage things, super complementary to a whole leader, that really gave me the confidence to take one of these type of opportunities on. When the board talked to me at first, I wasn't sure if I would be a fit, but after I started to study the industry, the company, it became my number one priority to try to get this role. Luckily, I came to the US, met with the founders, met with the board, and we really hit it off well. I think we had a very good aligned vision of where we wanted to take the company and what the potential of the company truly was. And so that aspect was fine. But one of my mentors in early March calls me and tells me, hey, you can't take this offer. You know, rescind it. Tell Amazon you're not quitting. Stay at Amazon. And I'm like, what? And he's like, look, you know, I'm talking to a lot of economists. This is a high-level executive in a large international company. And he's like, I'm talking to a lot of economists, and things are going to get really, really, really bad in the coming year from an unemployment, from a recession perspective. And I don't think it's the right time to be making a jump to this type of company. So I remember thinking, okay, what do I do? And I set up an hour session with my CFO and my COO separately to kind of understand what the dynamics were looking like, what was the health of the business, but more importantly, the trajectory since COVID had started. This was probably by mid to late March. And what I saw was that at a lot of the pressure points, things were in our favor because farms are essential businesses, because last mile delivery partners are essential businesses. So besides us having to work from home, the disruption to the corporate, the disruption to our supply chain was minimal. And I would even say potentially beneficial, because the farms had extra capacity. So as our sales and orders started to skyrocket, we were able to get the capacity that they had to be able to fulfill those orders. So from that perspective, I think it was really trying to do a little bit of homework before I got here. Obviously, there's an aspect where you just have to push the I believe button and have a little faith. Obviously, explaining that to my family was tricky, but uber supportive, and they've become used to the changing countries every 3-4 years based on my career. And so they've been very supportive. Now, when I got here is, I think, when reality started to hit, right? Like in paper, this all makes sense. You know, I used to have an old boss that told me, I can tell you about swimming, I can have you read a book, but until I push you in the pool, you're not going to understand. And so in concept, everything I did prepared me. But when you get here and you're locked into an apartment, nobody's in the corporate office, you know, almost 100 employees, nobody in the corporate office, you're locked in 50 square meter apartment for days on end by yourself with your family in another continent, time zones are such that you can't talk that often. It was difficult. It was really difficult. And I think that what got me through is establishing a routine. And so what I would do is I would block an hour and a half every single day where I would eat dinner with them. So they'd have dinner. We'd put Zoom computer in front of them, my Zoom in front of me, and I would eat my lunch while they were having their dinner. So establishing a lot of one-on-ones with different people on the team brought some normality to the situation. And again, I don't think it's been easy, but I have been very impressed with just the resilience of the employees, the resilience of people in general.
You know, you talk about potential and what you saw in joining the team there. Obviously a big move to leave a company like Amazon, where of course you would understand what the roadmap looks like for demand, I think, and how we organize selling things to people really, and really presenting them with the best solutions. But you know, in this market where you say there is so much potential, I'm just wondering about where brand sort of comes into that and what excites you about that. You will have the know-how of getting things done, but you know, at this level, I think it's quite different. So talk to me about what it means for you to join sort of a smaller operation.
So what I loved initially in digging in the first 30, 60 days is that there was what I call big and obvious. There was just some big and obvious areas for us to work in. You know, just pockets that we were playing in, but not well. And so we're going to be going through a bit of a reorganization of the company to focus on those big and obvious areas and carve them out as different business units. So to me, I think that the P&G and Amazon thinking helps me with that. Helps me see like, hey, this is a big opportunity that we're playing in, but not well. We need to break it out and have a lot of resources put against that. From the brand perspective, what really, really got me, Amazon's not a brand company, right? Like, so Amazon's brand has been built through execution, which I think is an undervalued model to building brand equity, right? If you don't have to advertise, if you execute extremely well at an extremely high bar over and over, that will create your brand. Right now, coming from Procter, I also believe there's other ways to create your brand, so it was a very good balance. What I loved here from my Procter hat, when I started to go through the process, my wife had ordered some flowers from a company in Germany just because of COVID to have flowers in the house. You start paying attention to little things. It blew me away that she was knowing when the postman was supposed to come to deliver the flowers and waiting for that. And when the flowers came, she was excited to open the box and you can see her facial expressions change. Fast forward a week later, in an interview with one of the board members, same thing. They tell me to hold on because they had a delivery. It was one of our flowers, package of flowers going to her house. She opens it and you can see her facial expressions change. And so to me, like, that's just brand gold, right? And what blew me away is you have a commodity category, extremely lifestyle category, extremely emotional category with absolutely no branding. You know, I started scratching my head. I'm like, wow. Like, and if you think about it, coffee, I don't think it's as emotional as flowers. And that's what gone through a branding transformation the last 30 years. Jewelry, like, I don't know why a brand has to matter in diamonds besides quality, but companies have done an amazing job with sterling silver, Tiffany's, building brands on things that we would otherwise think are a commodity. And so to me, that really excited me. And I always say that the type of challenge I want to take is when I talk about it and I can think about 50 ideas. Because then I know for the coming 2, 3, 4, 5 years, there's more than enough work to do going after those big and obvious areas, right? And so to me, branding in the flower industry is something that makes a lot of sense, you know, just from being such an emotional and lifestyle category.
You know, we are in quite an interesting time, obviously, as the world gets moving again. Obviously, we're in some places in still in the midst of the pandemic. I would be remiss to not ask you, though, about sort of the lessons you are bringing over. You talk about big and obvious. I love that term. And, you know, there is the thought that in some cases, bigger corporates need to be a little bit more nimble and they love to inject sort of buzzwords from the startup world and be more entrepreneurial. You hear that all the time, obviously. And there are many companies that are doing great things in that sense. But, you know, coming from two bigger, larger global companies and moving into that startup world for you, I wonder what you see is missing for many of these companies there that are thinking or setting out on their own, trying to do things on their own, trying to be those innovators, but really missing the mark in some sense. What are the things that you see that might be other big and obvious things that are missing in this space?
Well, you know, I'll kind of say this for both sides, like what's missing from the innovation perspective or the way you do innovation for the big companies and then for the small companies.
Sure.
I think for the small companies, it's focus, right? Like, I think you know, if you take the stereotypical entrepreneur that had the idea, right? This is a person that does well with ideas. a lot of times I'll talk to entrepreneurs and they have ideas left and right, left and right. But what that can happen is it can create a lack of clear focus in an organization to execute against the one thing you're supposed to do very well. Kind of going back to what I mentioned about execution can build your brand, right? And so to me, what I see in this company or other startups that I've seen or talked to is that maniacal focus on executing this one thing, right? And so none of the things that I'm planning in the coming 2-3 years have to do with candles or coffee or, no, it's flowers. It's maybe in 20 years we'll do something great, but while I'm here, it's flowers. Execute on getting farm fresh flowers directly to consumers, right? And so to me, that is really important. And I would tell any founder or any startup is just to make sure that you're super clear on what the strategy is. And more importantly, one of the quotes I use a lot is the importance of strategy is not just what you do, it's what you don't do, right? If you do everything, you don't have a strategy, right? There's a lack of a strategy. So by definition, to have a strategy, there's things you don't do because it's off strategy. And I think a lot of times founders struggle with that aspect. On the larger companies, what I find is that the accountability goes way too far up, right? And so sure, they want to have this new incubation unit and this and that, but that incubation unit reports to the GM, that reports to the president, that reports to the CEO. And when the GM has 99% of their revenue coming from their existing business and the ideas that are coming out are semi-cannibalistic, that GM, who's likely going to be there 2, 3, 4 years, is not going to allow that to happen. And so there's just an inherent conflict of interest, right, that I think keeps a lot of these companies from disrupting innovation. But I think that there's some companies that have done really well at forcing that to happen.
You gave some great advice there on execution and how that can really build a brand and build a company and help grow in this time. It's interesting where a lot of people, I think, will not only be looking for new talent that is available, but also looking for a little bit of guidance and leadership, perhaps, on where they are going. There's opportunity, I think, for companies to rise to the top that have been nimble and are sort of out there pushing themselves in this moment. But for someone that's new coming into a company that might be afraid, let's say, to shake things up too much, what might be your advice there on how to sort of rally the team and get things going in the right direction? Maybe that's reminding people that you can be the best at doing what you already doing and not doing more things.
You know, one of my growing pet peeves right now is that how companies are using COVID as an excuse, even when it's not genuine and there's no way to explain how it would impact them. So you call an online-only bank and they're like, we apologize about the COVID situation 5 months in, and you're on hold for 30 minutes because of the crazy times we're going through. And you're like, but how does that impact you, right? Like, if your people are still working from home, they can still take as many calls, potentially more. And so I feel like a lot of companies are using it as an excuse, and I think customers or patients will start to decline. So to me, to any company, large or small, don't use it as an excuse, right? Figure out, 5-6 months in, all companies should have figured out where the pain points are, fix those pain points to make sure that we're able to serve the customer, whatever industry we're in, well, right? Whatever well may mean by the new definition. And two, I'm a huge believer that customer habits are very hard to change, and they usually happen at generational changes more than they do within somebody's own life. And what do I mean by that? My wife hates buying groceries online. She doesn't like it. She prefers to go to the grocery store. COVID hits, guess what she was doing? She was buying groceries online. And now she tells me, I think it's easier to buy a lot of the things online. And so whenever you have these shocks to the systems, which don't happen often, consumers kind of back up and reevaluate their habits, their purchases, and so forth. If you can be really good at understanding where those reevaluations are happening, it's a huge opportunity for you to establish yourself and your brand and your company. So to me, I've never been one that likes the woe is me mentality. To me, it's like, you know, look at the situation and figure out how you adapt your brand to that situation, right? If this is the new normal for the next year, year and a half, I don't want to hear how you're dealing with unprecedented times, right? Figure it out. And I've been really, really surprised at the amount of companies that continue to use it as a problem.
Yeah, indeed. And great advice there. Very well said. Just lastly, Alejandro, I've taken a good deal of your time and I do appreciate that. I'd love to just hear about a few other things that are in the works for you guys at the moment in terms of getting things on track and being better at delivering the services that you already are offering.
Yeah, I mean, I think that right now the focus in the near term is going to be in the U.S., specifically executing our existing businesses and then expanding into going harder and more deliberate into subscriptions and playing a bigger role in weddings. I think that going back to my shock to the system, weddings and events have been shocked to the core. And I think there's opportunities for us to introduce ourselves and our services and the flexibility something like that brings. So as you're deciding the weddings and where it's going to be, how it's going to be, the flowers is the last thing you have to worry about. We'll figure it out. And wherever you want to have it, we'll ship to where you need to be. So those are the kind of areas we'll focus on in the short term. And then I'd love to start focusing on international probably in the 12 to 18 month period, at least starting to think about it. And so more than likely, Japan is going to be one of the first markets that we're going to consider. And they're also just starting to map what the rest of North America and potentially Europe looks like. And so to me, great things. I think the work from home has been challenging, but now all leaders have to figure it out. If this is the new normal, how do you keep your teams motivated? How do you keep the burnout as low as possible because of this new way of doing things is also something I'm spending a very, very good deal of my time on. Even looking into the benefits that we offer as a company, do our benefits meet the challenges our employees are having today? And that's something I would push on companies to think about. What are the new benefits we need to establish with this type of work arrangement?
Yeah, something very interesting to think about. And we do appreciate your forward-thinking view as well. I like to think I got a little bit of news out of you there, and we'll check back about Japan in the near future. That is an exciting thing to think about for sure. For now, Alejandro, thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful to speak to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you, Daniel.
Alejandro Bethlen, the CEO of The Books, speaking to me from California. You can learn more at books.com. Finally, on today's show, it's time to check in with a past guest. Alan Mahan is the founder of Brewgooder, a Scottish craft beer company launched in 2016 that donates 100% of its profits to clean water initiatives. Since we last spoke to Alan in May of last year, Brewgooder has been working with brewers all around the world on unique beer collaborations. Not only is it more sustainable in having the beer brewed in local markets, but it also helps Brewgooder to expand its reach. They've also teamed up with Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh to launch a bursary to encourage more Black, Asian, and minority ethnic students to pursue careers in brewing and distilling. For today, I asked Alan to tell me about the business lessons he's learned in the past few months and to offer some advice for other small business owners. As you'll hear, Alan says if you remember your core mission, there will be no shortage of new opportunities.
It's March 2020. Your team has worked for 6 months to coordinate the launch of totally unique beers with 250 brewers in 24 countries, all to help bring clean drinking water to 100,000 people on projects in Malawi. And there's just 1 week to go. Nothing can stop us, we joke. Only a freak event or an act of God, but what are the chances of one of those? Well, you know the rest. We can see all around us that the COVID-19 pandemic has been bad for business, some industries more than others. But what about those social and purpose-driven businesses like ours? Our world was turned upside down. Our business model of using the profits from our craft beer sales to fund clean water projects was stretched to breaking point, with 60% of our customers indefinitely closed. We had to reinvent what we did, pivot to direct-to-consumer, collaborate more closely with those customers still going, and build impact into every can sold. Because we were clearer now more than ever on why we did it, to empower people to build better lives for themselves. It's still too early to tell if these were the right moves, but we're still here and we're still moving in the right direction. So the big takeaway for me is something I probably always knew. that when you're guided by a North Star of purpose, pivoting comes naturally. And in times of crisis, with that star to guide you, you can even end up finding a better path and some more allies along the way. That's not just true for social businesses like ours. It's true of any business that exists for something. Because when you exist for something, your survival instincts are finely tuned and you know what you've got to live for.
Alan Mahan, founder of Brewgooder. My thanks to Alan. You can hear the full story on episode 150 of Eureka and learn more at brewgooder.com. That's all for this week. My thanks to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.